The Biden administration is considering reopening a controversial migrant detention center. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Homestead Temporary Shelter for Unoccupied Children was at the center of a lot of criticism aimed at the Trump administration. Thousands of teens were kept there, and it was shut down in 2019, but could it be reopened? Also, we're building more and more high-rises in South Florida. But even as we create more modern structures above ground, below it is an aging and failing infrastructure of pipes.
There would be times I would walk around the building, walking the dogs, and get hit with the smell of raw sewage.
Finally, alligator wrestling remains a tradition for the Seminole tribe. We meet Billy Barefoot Walker to share some stories from the gator pit.
My hair barely touches his tooth, and it clamped on my head.
All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. Well, the Biden administration is planning to reopen the Homestead Detention Center for Unaccompanied Migrant Teens. It was abruptly shut down in 2019 after a Miami Herald report found they didn't have a hurricane plan. Reports of sexual abuse followed, and it was later revealed that employees caring for the kids were not vetted specifically for prior child abuse records. The facility was used as a photo op for presidential hopefuls during their campaign. Vice President Kamala Harris was among those who visited and used it to criticize the Trump administration's immigration policies. Alex Dougherty is the Miami Herald's Washington correspondent. He's been following the story and joins us now. Alex, great to have you.
Thank you.
This is an exclusive story by the Miami Herald. Whom did you speak with?
Yeah, so we spoke with some folks in the Department of Homeland Security who are not authorized to speak publicly on this matter. And there's also some additional evidence out there showing that the facility is ramping up for potential operations.
I mean, what other indication did you get that the shelter's reopening?
So there's some job postings out there from a UK-based contractor that basically is a job posting that isn't finalized yet, but seems to suggest that the facility is ramping up potential staffing.
So it was through a job posting, and then from there, wow, okay. Is there a timeline for when the shelter is going to reopen?
So no, at this point, we don't know when it will reopen. The Biden administration opened up a facility in Texas earlier this week. That facility has already reopened. Part of the explanation for that is the COVID pandemic, basically forcing the administration to open additional facilities due to social distancing requirements. I've spoken with some congressional sources that have basically said Homestead is next in line for when it's expected through the spring and summer that unaccompanied migrant children crossing the border will increase, and Homestead would be used to fill that need.
And, you know, that operation was formerly run by a private company, Geo Group. Is that the case again?
So we don't know exactly who will be running this operation. That's a big sticking point, certainly, for many folks who followed this, folks who protested the center's reopening, members of Congress and other politicians who criticized the facility's operations. We don't have any information on how this facility will be operated, whether or not it will be run by a private company. That seems to be the potential case if this facility opens within a matter of months. But we do not have confirmation as to, you know, which potential contractor, which is ostensibly a for-profit company, would be running this center when it reopens.
So this facility, as I'd mentioned, closed back in 2019. Remind us of the details that led to that.
So the facility first opened in 2018 as the number of migrant children crossing the border began to increase, and that compounded through 2019 when we saw levels reach very high throughout the spring of that year. And eventually, though, it closed toward the end of 2019, at the end of the summer, as the number of children crossing the border decreased. And also, as you mentioned, the facility did not have an adequate place or plan in place for hurricanes. Many of these children were housed in tents, or many of the facilities inside the detention center were not permanent structures. So obviously they would not be able to withstand any sort of major storm. And that was the reason given for the facility's ultimate closure. Although it didn't formally close, it went into what's called warm status, which allows the federal government to reopen it rather quickly on a moment's notice.
Yeah, and we're talking about kids when they were crossing the border, mostly Central America and Mexico from those countries. Where were those kids sent after they left the Homestead facility?
So those kids would have been sent to either other facilities, or in some cases they were sent back to their home countries if that's where their family contacts or other contacts were residing, or they may have been placed with other relatives inside the United States as they awaited their claims to go through the immigration system. So there's really three options for those kids, and in all cases, these kids were here on a temporary basis. So you wouldn't see, you know, for example, a kid being sent to Homestead and staying there for a year. In many cases, the stays were for a matter of weeks or in some cases months.
So we don't have any indication at all that, you know, this is going to be run the same way as it was before. They're going to have the same number of kids. They're just doing what they did back in 2019.
Right. And so part of the issue, too, is that, you know, with COVID and potentially trying to, you know, make sure that kids who cross the border socially distance remain safe and have space. The Homestead facility was the largest facility in the country when it was operating. It's not clear how many beds would be operational in COVID times, but certainly prior to the COVID pandemic, there was the potential for thousands of children to be sent to Homestead if necessary.
Again, I'm talking with Alex Daugherty. He is the Miami Herald's Washington correspondent. We're talking about the Biden administration's plan to reopen the Homestead Detention Center for unaccompanied migrant teens. You can find the Miami Herald's reporting on the story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Alex, what have we heard from the White House, the Biden administration, on the potential of reopening this? What have they said?
So the White House, at least publicly, will not address the reopening of Homestead. They have publicly acknowledged that the facility in Texas has reopened, but have not done the same with the Homestead facility and haven't really given any specific details as to when this facility will reopen, how many people will be housed there, and what the running of that facility will look like. So they've acknowledged that this is an issue and that unaccompanied migrant children crossing the border will probably continue to be an issue, but they have not addressed the reopening of Homestead specifically.
And that facility in Texas, is that still run by the same group?
Yeah, so it's run in the same way that it was when it was previously open, and it basically is a shelter specifically for unaccompanied migrant children. So there's existing shelters for families who cross the border or parents and their children. This facility that's being reopened is for unaccompanied migrant children. There is already existing facilities for those children as well. But the problem being current, you know, with higher levels of folks crossing the border combined with social distancing requirements necessitated the opening of that Texas facility.
So did Biden or his administration give a reason why reopen? I mean, are we getting an influx of migrants again, or are we expecting an influx?
So they basically said that part of the reason for doing so was based on what you just said. There's an influx of migrants as well as a limited bed capacity. And the current levels of immigration across the border are a much higher than they were a couple of years ago at this time during the winter. In 2019, when we saw a massive spike throughout the spring, the levels are currently much higher than they were in 2019. So if we see a similar trend in 2021, combined with the coronavirus pandemic, there will be a need for beds and likely a shortage of beds unless there's a drop off in migration across the border.
Now, what are the alternatives that immigration advocates have put forward about these facilities? I mean, are they offering up ideas of where these kids could be going instead?
So the current, alternatives that are being put out there, and I talked with former Congresswoman Debbie McCarsel Powell earlier this week, who was instrumental in raising attention to the Homestead Center. It was her district when she was in Congress. And what she mentioned is that there are not-for-profit agencies like Catholic Charities who run much smaller group homes for children in this situation. So instead of being placed in what she calls a prison-like facility with hundreds or thousands of beds, they're placed in a home with maybe a few dozen or even in some cases less children. And what she says is a much more intimate and more humane environment. But the problem is, if there is a massive influx of children crossing the border, it doesn't appear that the current system of smaller not-for-profits who help the administration on this will be sufficient to cover the amount of beds that would be needed.
And McCarcel Powell lost a close race to Congressman Carlos Jimenez. Is she working in the immigration advocacy space now?
So she's been having conversations with folks across, if you want to call it the Democratic Party spectrum. It obviously is a bit politically thorny for Democrats. They don't want to be criticizing the president in many cases during the first weeks of his administration. But in the case of many local Democrats, they spent months decrying this facility, the way it was run, the access to the facility for elected officials and other immigration activists. And so it kind of presents a conundrum, especially for Democrats who, you know, as you mentioned, Kamala Harris campaigned out in front of the Homestead facility when she was running for president, talked about how it was like a prison and how it needed to shut down. And now we're in a situation where the Biden administration, confronted with the realities of how many children are crossing the border, is looking at reopening this facility.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember, you know, Kamala Harris and a number of other politicians, especially before the Democratic debate here in Miami, they went down there, got their photos taken, standing outside of the wall. Have we seen or heard from any of those folks or any maybe Florida legislators who also were very outspoken? Are they speaking up now?
So we haven't heard anything from Vice President Harris or any of the other prominent Democrats who ran for president on this. We have heard from local Democrats, in particular, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who actually was the first person to raise alarm when this facility was reopened in 2018 after it was previously opened during the Obama administration. And she came out and said, hey, I don't want this facility to be reopened. I certainly don't want a private for-profit company being involved in the business of, you know, caring for unaccompanied migrant immigrant children. Other Democrats, Miami-Dade Mayor Danielle Levine-Cava has said similar things. And, you know, we've also heard from immigration activists in South Florida who are very much opposed to any reopening of this facility, along with Miami-Dade County Democrats. But at the national level, the answer is no. We have not heard, really any kind of criticism of the Biden administration or simply, you know, wanting to change his policy.
And, you know, but you talk about Democrats wanting to be careful, you know, not to criticize the president so early on, you know, in his administration. But what about immigration advocates? What are they saying about this? You know, they were so outspoken when Trump was running it.
Yeah, and I think in this case, many of those most vocal folks during the Trump administration are being vocal about this reopening. There's even been some criticism of the facility in Texas that has already been acknowledged to reopen from some attorneys and activists in the immigration space. And so, yes, they're very much opposed to any kind of large scale facility that puts hundreds or thousands of children in one place. And, you know, certainly in the case of Homestead, didn't give them adequate protection from, you know, the elements if there was to be a major storm or hurricane. So, yeah, so it's in the case of the activist side of things, you're still really hearing this, although it is slightly different. There was a minority of children who were separated from their families at the border that were placed at Homestead. And that is something that Joe Biden has pledged not to do, which is to separate, you know, children who cross the border with their parents from one another.
Yeah.
When they make that cross.
And I got to clarify, I didn't say Trump wasn't running it. But during his administration that he was criticized for opening these centers. What are you hearing from Republicans? And I know Senator Marco Rubio has commented on this.
Yeah, I think what you're hearing from Republicans is, you know, partially hey, let's make sure the Democrats stick to their own words. They were the ones who called it a prison. It wasn't us. And, you know, wanting to make sure that there's a significant attention placed on this issue. We haven't heard a ton from Republicans so far. I would say politically, it just leaves them a slightly less in the bind. You know, Carlos Jimenez, who is now the congressman for Homestead, was mayor at the time. He visited there and came away with a very different interpretation of how that facility was run. He said it wasn't a prison-like facility and that he was comfortable with the conditions that the children there were placed in. It became an issue during his campaign. So at least politically, it doesn't really leave them in the same kind of bind that it does maybe for someone like Kamala Harris.
And just briefly, I mean, obviously it shut down because it wasn't ready for hurricanes. Has that been resolved?
So we don't know if there's been significant infrastructure improvements there, you know, whether there's maybe permanent buildings or hurricane-proof buildings that are there. I will say back when this facility was opened during the Trump administration, many of the children and the facilities to serve them were in tents or temporary structures. And I don't think there's ever been a formal hurricane plan put out, even when this facility was closed in 2019.
Alex Dougherty is the Miami Herald's Washington correspondent. Alex, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And again, you can read more of his reporting on this story of the Homestead Detention Facility on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, the gridlocked mess you see in South Florida roadways is happening underground, an investigation into our sewage crisis. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Shiny cities in South Florida that are growing up are sitting on top of old, rusted pipes down below. In December 2019, Fort Lauderdale was dealing with the worst sewage breaks Florida has ever seen. It lasted for 2 months. People are still worrying about the impacts on the environment, public health, and how long it'll take the city to revamp a system that's over 50 years old. And what Fort Lauderdale's going through could be a sign of things to come for other coastal cities in Florida, especially as rising seas push saltwater inland due to climate change. WLRN reporters Katie Switalski-Munoz and Jenny Stiletovich spent the past year investigating sewage woes in South Florida and found tourism and development are pushing the system to its limits.
This is WLRN News. I'm Katie Switalski-Munoz. In December 2019, in a world before the pandemic, Fort Lauderdale was dealing with the worst sewage breaks Florida has ever seen, and it lasted for 2 months. People are still worrying about the impacts on the environment, worrying about the public health risks, and worrying about how long it'll take the city to revamp a system that's over 50 years old. Fort Lauderdale has the most extreme example of a pipe problem.
What the city's going through could be a sign of things to come for other coastal cities in Florida. I'm Jenny Stiletovich. That maxing out bulging at the seams gridlock you feel on the highway, it's also happening underground. Infrastructure across the state just isn't keeping up with Florida's growing population. We wanted to know, why does flushing a toilet or doing the dishes seem like such a worrisome thing to do? We talked to experts, an engineer, land use attorneys, and residents, too, people living with and on top of this network of pipes carrying our wastewater.
The more informed you get, the more scared you get. You know what I mean?
It's not like you can see green sludge in the water. It's just brown.
When I was growing up in Fort Lauderdale, we used to water ski and swim off George English Park. The water used to be more clear, and there's places in the Keys where you can still see to the bottom.
Oh no, not in these canals. Shiny cities in South Florida that are growing up are sitting on top of rusted iron pipes down below. Like a lot of people, John Bordeaux started coming to Fort Lauderdale for vacations, then moved downtown full-time. We talked last winter, before the pandemic hit. He and a group of retired friends all used to meet at Timpano, an Italian steakhouse on Las Olas Boulevard. We were there with the waiters as they got ready for the night ahead.
And the first few years were great, all right? But then over time, the more informed you get, the more scared you get. You know what I mean?
And some people who live in downtown Fort Lauderdale are scared enough to leave. Last year, Bordeaux moved to Sarasota.
I'm happy to be moving, and I've been planning this for a while. And as far as what the city promises, how many years have they been promising this? Okay? They've been promising it for years.
There are a lot of people in Fort Lauderdale who are not happy with the way the city kept approving new buildings leading up to the sewage spills and ignoring the pipe problems underground. That's ignited plenty of fights over the years in City Hall. Residents often want fewer new hotels, condos, and tall apartments going up. Bob Garofolo also left Fort Lauderdale a few years ago. He moved to Boca Raton, and that was before the big spill started, but after the spill in the Himmerich Canal in 2016. He said sewage and all the constant building were a part of what made him move away.
One of the reasons why I left where I was up by the beach was because of the sewage trucks. As I mentioned earlier, there would be times I would walk around the building walking the dogs and get hit with the smell of raw sewage. And it would not be unusual to see one of those tank trucks outside a day later or even that afternoon pumping what I can imagine out of that sewer line.
Since a little over a year ago, December 2019, Fort Lauderdale sewage mains have seeped more than 211 million gallons of raw sewage into people's yards.
The smell was horrendous. Whew.
And mostly into the canals and waterways the city's known for.
I mean, this city exists because of its waterways. It's supposed to be the Venice of America, right? Well, not if the waterways are polluted.
The pipe breaks have felt like dominoes falling.
Fort Lauderdale appears to have another sewage spill.
Another sewer main break has occurred in the city
the
of Fort Lauderdale.
The saga of sewer main breaks
close
in
to
Fort Lauderdale continues.
Million gallons. That's enough to fill 320 Olympic-sized swimming
Many
pools.
Many worry the damage could take years to reverse, with more sewage spilled than oil leaked during the Deepwater Horizon disaster.
According to the city of Fort Lauderdale, the prior administration, under the last city manager, Lee Feldman, took $120 million earmarked for utilities, like sewage and pipes, and used it instead to balance the general budget over the course of 6 years. The practice was stopped in 2020, 2 years after Feldman was fired.
Fort Lauderdale's sewer problems may be among the most urgent, but older coastal cities all over Florida are also trying to keep up with the wear and tear. Climate change is driving seas higher, and that means these pipe problems will only get worse. As the seas rise, saltwater is creeping further inland, and that corrodes old pipes and pushes more groundwater into leaky pipes.
You know, we are at, I think, a point of reckoning.
Richard Grosso is a Nova Southeastern University law professor and land use expert.
And if we don't get a handle on paying for the investments we need to maintain that, because we're still falling over each other, fighting for new development that we're also then going to have to protect. I mean, that's the day of reckoning that we're having.
New development, new homes, new condos, new buildings. That's a key clue in how we got here. Grosso says our fundamental problem is rooted in how the state has managed how it grows and the cost of roads and schools and pipes.
They're not even paying for themselves, let alone helping you upgrade for the existing development.
He says hooking up all these new buildings to old pipes only compounds the problem.
We've got a collection system that's made for 1970s population. I mean, that's exactly the larger macro problem we have in South Florida.
It's a problem because of the way new development gets sold to the public. We've all heard it a zillion times. New development brings more money with new and higher taxes. We assume the money covers the cost of maintaining sewer pipes, but it doesn't.
And that's not ever accurate. It's never been accurate.
Grosso says what you don't hear is developers don't get charged nearly enough taxes to pay for the services they need. And it's not like we haven't seen boom and bust Florida before. Florida's history is all about booming and busting. In the 1970s and 80s, the state's population was growing by 1,000 new residents a day. That's like adding a new Tampa or Orlando or two Fort Lauderdales every year. Lawmakers realized we were headed for trouble as more people kept moving to the state. So Grosso says in 1985, Governor Bob Graham helped Florida become the first state in the country to put strict rules in place to keep Florida from growing too fast. The rules gave the state power to keep growth from snowballing and overwhelming the roads and schools and sewer pipes.
There was a mechanism that kept one local government from approving development that was going to strain its neighbors. You know, we put in a big new mall and now I'm overloading traffic into all the cities that surround me. I get the tax base from the new mall. You all get the traffic.
Then the housing market collapsed in the mid-2000s and people stopped moving to Florida for the first time in decades. So the state tossed out its rule book for controlling growth. Governor Rick Scott also did away with the state agency that monitored development. Instead, he created the new Department of Economic Opportunity to get people to move here again. And guess what? We're back to getting about 1,000 new residents a day moving to Florida. Grosso compares what's going on now to a Ponzi scheme.
It brings in that new money, but it brings with it, you know, a bill that's going to come due later. And then, oh, we have to approve new development to pay for that old bill. And it's not just a Fort Lauderdale problem. It's a problem throughout the state of Florida.
And we are so connected to our water in Florida. We use it to lure tourists and sustain the second biggest agricultural industry in the nation. We supply the winter crop of tomatoes and beans and a bunch of other vegetables. If you weren't born here, you probably moved here because of the water. But now the pipes that help keep it clean are breaking.
And we keep pushing that envelope, pushing it down the way to say, hey, you know, we're really at that critical point. We need to expand the system.
Sierra Maton is an engineer with the American Society of Civil Engineers. She gave Florida a C for its sewer system and a D for stormwater in the society's latest nationwide report.
A lot of times people don't understand what we do or what the big deal is until something goes wrong, right? You know, we live in the state of Florida and we have a beautiful place to live because of the work that people do in the shadows, if you will, under the ground.
Conditions have gotten so bad in South Florida that environmental regulators put some local governments under legal mandates, telling them how to fix their sewer systems.
Miami-Dade County is under a federal consent order, its third after failing to comply with two previous orders dating back to the 1990s.
Fort Lauderdale and West Palm Beach are under state orders to correct problems, and they have ongoing cleanup plans. With its order, Fort Lauderdale also got a hefty fine, $2.1 million for polluting water with sewage between December 2019 and February 2020. That's the largest penalty for a sewage spill in state history. Instead of paying the fine, Florida's giving the city the option to spend above and beyond the repair costs on things that help the environment, like planting mangroves, cleaning up canals, or even building seawalls. So far, the city's come up with a list of projects worth more than twice what it was fined, and it's asked for 4 years to get them all done. In the meantime, even as most of the city was shut down during the COVID crisis, construction has continued on the biggest problem, which is this more than 7-mile-long old sewer main that kept breaking last year. It's like a main highway for much of the city's sewage. The new $65 million pipe is on track, and sewage is already flowing through part of it.
Maton, the engineer, says cities are also rethinking how they maintain these old systems and watch for breaks. That's a huge job.
A lot of times, you know, these systems are in place for 50, 60 years, and it was just a plot on a set of plans.
Now they're converting those old blueprints on paper to digital formats with monitors to continuously check for signs of sewer breaks and spills.
You know, you think about how large the city of Fort Lauderdale is and all of the water and wastewater piping that's connecting businesses, homes, all of that. And all of that has to be marked and plotted. And it's costly.
Stan Eichelbaum lives in downtown Fort Lauderdale. And when we talked before the pandemic, he was thinking about how this whole mess with pipes breaking so often has changed everyday life.
The conversation in the city has shifted from which restaurant am I going to tonight to what is the living condition of the city, all in the livability of the city.
And whether to stay.
It's probably going to take billions of dollars to fix the pipes in South Florida alone. But land use attorneys we talked to, including Thomas Rupert from the University of Florida, have another idea. Control where homes and condos and buildings are being built and how big they are better.
I use the metaphor of a drug addict. I mean, we just can't wait for our next fix. I mean, we just can't. We've been doing this for a century now, and it's what everything is structured around in Florida. Is the idea of growth. If we think about property rights as only about individuals, then it's all about me and my property. And when we argue that way, does that mean that my right to do whatever I want with my property, if I claim that right, does that mean others have to pay the costs of what that implies for the rest of society? Do you have to pay for exorbitant costs for infrastructure? Because of my decisions, do you have to pay to rescue me if something goes wrong?
Fort Lauderdale and the rest of South Florida were still largely seasonal resort towns when most of the pipes were installed in the 1970s. People flocked south in the winter. Summers emptied out. Less than 3 million people live between Palm Beach County and the Keys.
Now it's more than twice as many, not counting tourists, living on top of virtually the same pipes. I'm Katie Spitalski-Munoz in Fort Lauderdale.
And I'm Jenny Stiletovich in Miami. This is WLRN News.
And you can find the web story at WLRN.org. And tune into the South Florida Roundup tomorrow to hear more details of the investigation. Well, still to come.
My hair barely touches his tooth and it clamped on my head.
We introduce you to a Seminole alligator wrestler. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. This month, we've been reading Swamplandia by Karen Russell for our Sundial Book Club. You can go back and listen to our interview with her at WLRN.org/sundial. The setting of the story takes place in a fictitious theme park in the middle of the Everglades. A family, pretending to be Native American, is trying to attract visitors through their alligator shows. Alligator performances like gator wrestling has been around for decades in Florida, and it might have started with the Seminole tribe. We recently spoke with Billy Barefoot Walker, a Seminole alligator wrestler, and we started by asking how he found himself getting into this tradition.
Around my grandfather's time, they would live in the villages on the side of the road. The road was built by their villages, and they would move out of the woods by the swamps. And 41 was built right in the middle of the Everglades, so the villages was all around there. So when the settlers started, or tourists, people traveling, they seen Indian men catching the alligators in the water and stuff. And then Indian men was catching them for a food source, because whatever you killed is what you ate that day. Or you had to go make a garden. And then so what happens is younger men will go off to hunt for 4 or 5 days. That elder would kill that gator for what they needed to eat it. They would get the gator hides and the deer hides, take it to the coastal areas to trade for rickrack, beads, guns, and gunpowder and other materials. And that's how we got our possum kind of pans and other materials. That was passed down from my grandpa, what the settler had said. It looked like the Indian man was wrestling an alligator, which he wasn't. He was getting ready to catch it for food. But what happened is when the settler threw money at us, at them, it changed their whole world and changed their ways of life the most from what the breastmaker had gave us.
That's so, it's so interesting. I'm wondering, as you were growing up, you know, you were just surrounded by that. You saw your relatives doing it. And so was it just a natural thing for you to follow in the footsteps and do this?
I heard my grandpa doing it. I seen him when we went hunting and stuff, hunting deer. Back in the 80s, we didn't get no money. But when we hunted food, we had a hunt. So I see my grandpa, they would send him across the canal to get the deer on the other side. I asked him, I said, why do you send grandpa? You know, why don't your uncles do it? He said, well, grandpa used to do gator shows, and he knows how to handle the alligator. And I said, oh, okay. So that was one of the things that I was like, well, I'm going to start doing that. I'll get y'all's deer. You know, I'll get our deer. So, and I started hunting alligators. And when I started hunting alligators, that's when I started, my cousins and my sister and them started daring me to put my hand in their mouth without it biting, kissing his nose, do Everglades jump rope, like do a poke the alligator and make him sweep his tail towards you, and you jump back and forth over his tail, and we call that Everglades jump rope. But we put our hand in there and hit the bottom of his jaw real fast and come out and bring our fingers up. Say, that's how we trim our nails in the Everglades. So we're just doing different stunts, and I found out the tourists would come through the reservation, and they would throw money at us. So the more tricks I would do, the more times I would get money, the more times we would go to the store or we'd go to the movies in town. We went to town like one time in 1 year. And when I started doing that, I found out, wow, you know, I got a passion. You know, I got something that my roots, and I haven't been bit. You know, I've been bit 3 times already, but.
You're telling me that, you know, you decided you wanted to hunt gators, and then, you know, your family, you had members of your family kind of taunting you to, you know, have fun and play around. But I mean, is there training for this? Do you have to go through some process to learn how to do it right so that you don't get hurt or you don't get killed?
Well, my uncles had started teaching me at a younger age, just by watching grandpa and everybody, and my dad, he taught me a few things. And, cause I didn't really go to a lot of shows, but I did see, some people doing shows, but there was a man called, his name was Thomas Storm, and he's the one that kind of showed me how to do a show. And then from there, there was another fellow named Paul Simmons. And he showed me a few things. And then I went from there, and they turned me loose, and I started doing shows.
Do you remember that first show back in 1988? Do you remember what it was like?
Yeah, because I ended up getting bit on my head. That's what started on my head.
Tell us about this. What happened?
I didn't work my alligator the way I was supposed to. I was young, and when you're young, you think you know it all, you know. And I jumped in, and then I worked the gator. It was in the yard, but it was like a little pond there, and pulled him out. And I did a good show with the 8.5-footer, and I pulled out the small one. I worked the big one and did the show, and then I jumped on a small one. So I'm figuring that small one, I didn't have to work it. But I found out that you can either work all alligators, you know, like working it, maybe like seeing his personality, popping his jaws with a stick, seeing how much power he has in there, desensitize his mouth before you make a move or get on it to put your head in it. And I didn't do anything like that. So my hair barely touched his tooth, and it clamped on my head. So it didn't really pop too bad, like get a good grip, but it did shake a little bit and put a hole in my head.
I'm wondering, are there any alligators that you can't train, you can't work them, they scare you, you just don't want to go near them?
Yeah, there is some alligators out there that, you know, I can walk up to them. I've been doing it long enough that you can pull a wild alligator, and just the show is going to be amazing. You know, I can go over there and you're watching them trying to figure out how to catch this alligator. So, you know, there's gators that you can walk around, like he would try to shoot his tail into his mouth, and you work them, like in a circle, work them the other way and pop his jaws. You desensitize them, and sometimes some gators, you can jump on their back. We call it a quick catch, when you jump on their back and hold their neck. And then but some gators, they would roll. So if they're a rolling alligator, there's a way that you can go in front of the alligator and go up under his lower jaw and push it up to his top upper jaw and push it back, and then you can go ahead and make get your right hand or your left hand and put it on top and get a good grip and get on his back. I think I ran into about four mean ones in my time, and I couldn't get on them. But I have. I have, and they said, Billy, that was unreal. You know, I've never seen anybody get on that alligator. The alligator would train you. So when you come into the pit or anywhere you go, if you're supposed to do a quick catch on a frontal catch or a frontal catch on a quick catch, you can be bitten. It's called show train. So it's just you got to figure out how to catch that alligator.
Billy, how many times have you been bitten?
I've been bit 3 good times on my head, and about bit my pointing finger, my ring finger, my middle finger, my left hand, about bent it off. And those 3, they couldn't stitch it up, but it broke my finger, my ring finger. And it walked me probably about 6 foot. It was probably about a 250-pound alligator. And it was a female. She got a hold of me, and she cracked it. It sounded like a chicken bone cracking around a gator barrel. Everybody was like, what? You all right? I said, I don't know yet. And then, you're just getting shocked. And then that gator just let go. I looked at my finger. It was dangling there. They had put my finger in some bleach and water. And I looked at it. I said, whoa.
So I'm just amazed at that, you know, especially after you get bitten on your head, that you still want to keep doing this. I mean, have you ever had a moment where you thought, this isn't going to end well, I should stop?
Yeah, I did. And it was probably... it was 2013. If you go to YouTube and look up Sunmo Tribal Fair 2013, there's going to be some Aztec dancers. So you push on there on YouTube, and you there's a time when I jumped in. It don't show that part, but it was around that 2 days before I was in the water, and I was doing a show for the Sunmo Tribal Fair, and I dove in, and I thought I was gonna get bit. I was on top, just like some wake, where it was splashing around. It came out of my hand. I had the gator's bottom of the jaw, and she was slinging around. He slung out of my hand because I got bit on my left hand, so I couldn't get a good grip. And I seen that mouth open. It was coming back, and I put my left arm up with my elbow above the water like, and I was like, okay, here it goes. Here I'm going to get bit. And then when I closed my eyes, I have no idea what happened, but I didn't get bit. And then once I got done with the show, I was like, you know, I said, I think it's about time for me to retire. I said, I've been getting lucky so much that you never know. I don't know when my time's going to be when I get a serious bite again. And I was like, man. Then I looked, and, you know, I kind of felt like, dang, man, this is what I got to do for my people. I said, I can't stop. I said, unless somebody else steps up, and then that's when I stop. And then I hear all my people. They said, Billy, you know, you're doing good. You're doing good. Keep up with it. They said, you'll probably be an 80, 90-year-old man still doing this. And I mean, it changes my mind. You know, I'm like, no, I need to stick with it.
You're a dad. Do any of your kids want to follow in your footsteps?
Yeah, I got a little boy. His name is Jonah Walker, and he's 7 years old, and he jumps in the pit. I got videos of him, and he gets out there. And I got another son. His name is Julian Billy, and he's talking about wanting to learn. But my other son, he's not really into it. So, but my daughter would do a show in a heartbeat. There's more girls that want to do it than the guys.
Yeah,
besides me, I'm like, wow.
How many are there? Yeah. How many within the tribe? How many women do it?
There ain't too many people that do it like for a living. But I know there's some girls out here that must have learned. They're young. They're probably about 13 on down, but there's a couple of girls that done it before. There was a lady a long time ago, and my uncle was married to her, and Moses Jumper, and my uncle I don't know what happened to him, but his wife Betty Mae Jumper had. When he was, yeah, I guess he fell asleep, and then Betty Mae came in and did the Gator Show, and we talk about her a lot. She's like a legend to us, and she was a snake clan, but she did a Gator Show, and everybody looks up to that story. I love that.
That was Billy Barefoot Walker of the Seminole Tribe. You can check out some videos of him alligator wrestling. It's on our Sundial Book Club page on Facebook. I promise none of the videos are of him getting bitten, but they're fun. They are fun. Well, staying in the swamps of the Everglades, we wanted to end today's show on a lighter note and introduce you to Yadira Kapaz. She came up with the idea for swamp therapy as a way to connect more people to the Everglades. It's a little like retail therapy, only muddier, and it involves art and meditation and history. Well, former WLRN intern Maria Eskinka joined the hike at Big Cypress National Preserve, and we should note this story was reported prior to the start of the COVID-19 pandemic.
I think when people think of a swamp, they think of like a mosquito-infested area. They think of a place where humans can't really move through.
The Everglades can be uncomfortable. It can be far, it's hot, it's swampy. Yadira Kapaz wants to reclaim the word swamp.
Let's connect to the swamp. Let's learn from the swamp. Let's listen. Let's create and be inspired by it.
She calls it swamp therapy.
It is an invitation for people to connect with nature and the wildness that's in our backyard.
Dozens of alligators lounge under the sun. A sleek white egret trots by. An anhinga spreads its black wings. Tourists rest their elbows on the wooden rail of the boardwalk and stare at animals. Gaze through their binoculars. They ooh and ah, take pictures. The dirt path morphs into limestone. Chunks of mud cover the white stones. To avoid the mud means to play a game of don't step on the lava. But Kapaz encourages the group to take off their shoes, to feel the cold mud ooze through their toes. Wait,
like, how often do we really, like, give ourselves permission to interact with...
Let's give it a try.
With mud?
It's, like, cold, too. It feels, like, really nice.
This is the real swamp therapy right here.
The Everglades is a paradox. Quiet.
It's, like, soft.
And loud. To feel its magic, you have to listen.
You hear that?
The crunch of grass, the snap of twigs, The rustle of leaves.
Palm fronds. The sound of them. It sounds very industrial to me. I feel like I heard this before, like a factory.
Drops of dew on a spider web glisten like rhinestones.
Oh, how beautiful. So what? Oh, wow.
It's super precious.
Tiny spider eggs.
Oh, I see a little spider right there.
Oh, no. It was only a year ago that Yadira Capaz started coming to the Everglades.
Grown up in Miami since I was 8 years old. I came from Cuba, and I maybe went to the Everglades once as a child in my elementary school.
Last year, she was invited to go on a hike by indigenous activist Houston Cypress, who started the Love the Everglades movement.
And it was that hike through Big Cypress that really sparked my curiosity and opened me up to that world.
Capaz kept coming back to the Everglades, and for her, part of the connection is the idea of decolonization.
It's a big word, right? Like, what does it mean to decolonize? For me, it starts with learning about indigenous people, understanding the history of the land that you're on, and finding a way to listen to the wisdom that they have kept and share.
Capaz has Taino and Yoruba ancestry, indigenous and Afro-Latino groups in Puerto Rico and Cuba. During the swamp therapy hikes, Capaz talks about the Calusa tribe. They lived in the Everglades before the Seminoles and the Miccosukee tribes.
I'm not trying to take something from another culture. I'm sharing it in the same way that people share like quotes from Socrates. Like, I think that they're the same value of like important information.
Capaz leads the group in a 7-direction prayer. It's a ritual she learned from members of the Anishinaabe tribe.
Pachamama, Madre Tierra. If you can and want, I recommend like putting your full forehead to the earth.
The group crouches down, touches the dirt with their hands, lowers their faces to the grass.
And that was former WLRN intern Maria Eskinka. Again, we should note this story was reported prior to the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, that is Sundial for this Thursday, February 25th. Sundial senior producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Zaria Reimer is our intern. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepery. Our news director is Taryn Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zabka. Our technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo. Go Palo.com for more. And by the way, don't forget you can download a podcast of this program. Just search WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. Well, coming up next week on the program, how are queer students managing the social isolation that comes with virtual schooling? We're going to learn about an organization in Palm Beach County connecting directly with students and providing guidance and support during these challenging times. Now, as we've mentioned, you know, we've been reading Swamplandia by Karen Russell for our February book for the Sundial Book Club. Hope you enjoyed the book. Don't forget, you can go back and listen to our interview with Karen. Just go to WLRN.org/sundial. And we'd always love to hear from you. We want to know what you think about the book choices that we make and also about the interviews that we do. And also while you're there and find us on Facebook, just join the Sundial Book Club. It's free. We'd love to have you. Tell us what you're reading right now. What books are you reading at this time? What's getting you excited? Well, it is time to announce the March title. Next month, we're going to be diving into Find Me in Havana by Serena Burdick. The story follows Estelita Rodriguez, a Cuban singer and actress from the 1940s, who makes her way to the U.S. and eventually to Hollywood. The book is available online and in local bookstores. Find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Again, the book for the month of March, Find Me in Havana by Serena Burdick. Thank you again so much for listening. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, stay safe. Have a great Friday. Have a great weekend. Stay safe. Be good to each other. We'll be back again live on Monday.